Thanks so much, Tannen. Those of you who were able to be here last Sunday night for the second Sunday service that Sandra and some others led, I know that was just such a beautiful time. I'm really impressed with how Avery and some others have built a beautiful backdrop that they have behind the stage on that evening. I just think that's really impressive. I have to admit, though, I'm wondering, they do this for the Shabbat service, why don't they do this for me when I preach? I think it's something like this, Dr. J right here behind me, or J-Lo, that's kind of my other little name. So I'm watching for that to show up one Sunday here when I stand up to preach. I think that'll be really, really good. That'll be a good Sunday. There we go. Well, we're in a series on mental health issues and understanding the church's role in welcoming those who are struggling and realizing that we ourselves in our midst have, just by the sheer percentages in our society, a large number of people struggling with anxiety and depression. And recognizing that as we move out into the world as a part of God's mission, that we undoubtedly are going to encounter individuals who are struggling with depression and anxiety and other mental illnesses. And being able to empathize and sympathize, but also minister appropriately to those struggling with these issues is important for us as a church. So I want to begin this morning by asking this question. Are you made just as God intended? The psalmist declares, "For it was you who formed me in my inmost parts. You knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made." Do you believe that you are fearfully and wonderfully made? Do you wish there were a couple things about you that were different? Or as the Lord said to Jeremiah, when Jeremiah, as a young man, a boy of maybe 14, 15, was called to be a prophet, a spokesperson for God, and Jeremiah was saying, "Lord, I'm too young, call somebody else." But the Lord said to Jeremiah, "Before I formed you in the womb, I knew you." Do you believe that God knew you before you were even born? Or Job, as he's struggling and wrestling with what's happened in his life and his upright standing before God, Job says, "The Spirit of God has made me, and the breath of the Almighty gives me life." Do you believe that it's God's Spirit that sustains you and that has made you who you are? Well, I think the obvious question to follow up with this is, so if God has made me with his own hands and formed into me the breath of life, then why do I struggle? Why do I have things in my life that aren't the way I wish they were? Why do I not live up to some ideal, some level of perfection that I think should be there? You know, when a baby's born, there are exceptions, but when a baby is born, usually that baby is perfect. It may be a little fat or a little skinny. It may have lots of hair or no hair. It may have a squished head because of the way it was born, or it may have a perfectly round head because of a C-section. But regardless, most babies are perfect, aren't they? That's what we say, a perfect baby. 10 fingers, 10 toes. Talk about babies. Most babies are just so perfect. And then our childhood, most of our childhoods are pretty good. I mean, we have this typical childhood issues. We might not get along with our parents at times. We might have issues growing up and learning to obey and making some mistakes. But most of us, you know, look back on our childhood, and it was a standard childhood, a pretty normal childhood. But not all childhoods are normal. Some childhoods have real struggles. And that's it. As we grow older, every single one of us breaks down eventually. Just talking with our dear brother Bob Cross this morning. He's talking about his eyesight. It's just not what it used to be. Every single one of us is going to break down in one way or another. Some of us, it happens in our 20s. We begin to have some health issues or some other issues. Some of us, it happens in our 50s. Sometimes it's our 70s. But every single one of us eventually is going to not measure up to the level of vitality, strength that we wish we had. And so when we are less than, are we still made in God's image? Are you still a person filled and sustained by the breath of God, even when you're not what you wish you were? Then there are environmental things that happen to us. There are accidents that happen. Some people get injured. Then there are others who ingest pollutants, that chemicals that destroy their nervous system or their neurological system. There are others that breathe pollutants in that cause permanent damage to their respiratory system. There are others that simply get sick. Are you no longer made in God's image if you have an accident or if you are sick? What about the other standards that society creates? There are some standards of dexterity that we measure people by. There are standards of race, skin color, sexuality, gender, even intelligence that we call people normal according to. Are you made in God's image if you don't measure up to the standards of society? Well, obviously, we're going somewhere with this today. And so I want us to begin this morning thinking about the struggle of depression. Instead of a testimony this morning, I want to share a video that Cindy McGrady was kind enough to point me toward. This is an excellent video that helps us understand the struggle of depression. So I want to play that for us now as we think about the challenges of mental health issues.
I had a black dog. His name was Depression. Whenever the black dog made an appearance, I felt empty and life just seemed to slow down. He could surprise me with a visit for no reason or occasion. The black dog made me look and feel older than my years. When the rest of the world seemed to be enjoying life, I could only see it through the black dog. Activities that usually brought me pleasure suddenly ceased to. He liked to ruin my appetite. He chewed up my memory and my ability to concentrate. Doing anything or going anywhere with the black dog required superhuman strength. At social occasions, he'd sniff out what confidence I had and chase it away. My biggest fear was being found out. I worried that people would judge me. Because of the shame and stigma of the black dog, I was constantly worried that I'd be found out. So I invested vast amounts of energy into covering him up. Keeping up an emotional lie is exhausting. Black dog could make me think and say negative things. He could make me irritable and difficult to be around. He would take my love and bury my intimacy. He loved nothing more than to wake me up with highly repetitive and negative thinking. He also liked to remind me how exhausted I was going to be the next day. Having a black dog in your life isn't so much about feeling a bit down, sad, or blue. At its worst, it's about being devoid of feeling altogether. As I got older, the black dog got bigger and he started hanging around all the time. I'd chase him off with whatever I thought might send him running. But more often than not, he'd come out on top. Going down became easier than getting up again. So I became rather good at self-medication, which never really helped. Eventually, I felt totally isolated from everything and everyone. The black dog had finally succeeded in hijacking my life. When you lose all joy in life, you can begin to question what the point of it is. Thankfully, this was the time that I sought professional help. This was my first step towards recovery and a major turning point in my life. I learned that it doesn't matter who you are, the black dog affects millions and millions of people. It is an equal opportunity mongrel. I also learned that there was no silver bullet or magic pill. Medication can help some, and others might need a different approach altogether. I also learned that being emotionally genuine and authentic to those who are close to you can be an absolute game changer. Most importantly, I learned not to be afraid of the black dog, and I taught him a few new tricks of my own. The more tired and stressed you are, the louder he barks, so it's important to learn how to quiet your mind. It's been clinically proven that regular exercise can be as effective for treating mild to moderate depression as antidepressants, so go for a walk or a run and leave the mutt behind. Keep a mood journal. Getting your thoughts on paper can be cathartic and often insightful. Also keep track of the things that you have to be grateful for. The most important thing to remember is that no matter how bad it gets, if you take the right steps, talk to the right people, black dog days can and will pass. I wouldn't say that I'm grateful for the black dog, but he's been an incredible teacher. He forced me to reevaluate and simplify my life. I learned that rather than running away from my problems, it's better to embrace them. The black dog may always be part of my life, but he'll never be the beast that he was. We have an understanding. I've learned through knowledge, patience, discipline and humour, the worst black dog can be made to heal. If you're in difficulty, never be afraid to ask for help. There is absolutely no shame in doing so. The only shame is missing out on life.
So I would just simply add to that that there's a real place for religion and for church when it comes to helping heal and recover from the struggles of mental health issues. Sandra shared with me a blog post recently containing several do's and don'ts about how to talk to someone who suffers from depression. And I think these are on the handout that's in your bulletin, so feel free to take that home with you. Just hang it on your refrigerator. Think about these things. There's also on the backside some thoughts for you to be able to meditate on during the week ahead. But here's some things not to say to people struggling from depression. Don't tell the person to cheer up or think positive. This is not just simply a choice people are making. This is something deep within the brain that is not a matter of simply snapping your fingers and getting over it. Don't make at least comments to people. Say things like, well, at least you have a husband, or at least your kids are good, or at least you have a job. Those at least comments show that you have no clue what depression really is. Don't tell someone that depression is a sin. For the love of God, please don't say that. That's not helpful, as I talked about last week. Don't suggest vitamins or chicken soup or a trip to Cozumel, as much as we all might enjoy that. Those kind of home remedies that may have worked for you to cure your blues is not the same thing that someone needs to really get through actual clinical depression. It may be that you have helpful things, but don't oversimplify other people's issues by trying to play home doctor to people. Oh, I read in Good Housekeeping such and such. No, don't do that. Instead, do these things. Do ask, are you having suicidal thoughts? You'd be surprised how many people struggling with depression think about wanting to end their pain. And if someone obviously responds yes, then you can call me, you can talk to others who have an ability to be able to step in and perhaps. Sometimes just simply talking about those desires is not the same as actually being suicidal, but still, those are real things. Do stick around and be present if possible. So let me say a don't here. Don't promise people things that you can't do or won't do. Don't say, I'll see you tomorrow, I'll talk to you tomorrow, unless you're really going to call tomorrow. Don't promise to do things for others that you can't really do. But if possible, do be there. Do come by. Do help with the laundry. Do whatever you can do. Stick around. Be present. Don't diagnose. Don't prescribe. Just be present. Do tell the person they are important to you. Even if that doesn't sink in at the moment, it's important to remind people that you care, that you love them, that they mean something to you. And do say that you're sorry to hear about the pain they're experiencing. Just say you're sorry. So sorry. Well, the challenge is that many Christians tend to deny the legitimacy of mental illness. And I don't fully know the roots of this, and I don't know that even if I did, that we had time to explore it now, but there are things in our society as well that just simply deny the reality of mental illness. But it's especially true in church, where we tend to think that God should be able to fix things if we have enough faith. That if you have enough faith, you shouldn't be depressed. It's sinful to be depressed if you're someone who loves God. It's sinful to be anxious if you're someone who loves God. Well, there may be anxiety that is sinful. There may be depression that is sinful. But the clinical anxiety, the clinical depression, is not about sin. It's about your body not quite working right, your brain being broken in some small way or big way. And so here's some reasons why I think Christians tend to deny the legitimacy of mental illness. And I'm adapting these from a book that we have for sale out in the foyer, Grace for the Afflicted by Matthew Stanford, a really helpful book, which I think really helps explain clearly the different types of mental illness, which I think is helpful to know, just to understand these things that we sometimes hear about, bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, and those types of things. So one reason why some Christians tend to deny the legitimacy of mental illness is because some think there are no exact tests to diagnose mental disorders. And while it may be that it's different from the flu in that you can't do a blood test that comes back 2 days later and says, yep, sure enough, you've got the flu, that there are real things that professionals look at to actually say people have these diseases of the brain. Psychology and psychiatry are not voodoo. They are real sciences, peer-reviewed sciences that have standards. And so diagnoses are not just simply made-up things to be able to charge people money. These are real disorders. So that's one reason some may struggle with understanding that mental illness is real. Another is that some think that a diagnosis in one person may look quite different from the same diagnosis in someone else. And there's a lot of truth to this, because someone who's depressed may sleep all the time, whereas another person who's depressed may not be able to sleep. And so you say, well, how can you both be depressed? Because this is a different symptom from what that person has. But see, the mental illness takes a hold of people in different ways. Number three, medications and treatments don't always successfully treat mental illness. We sometimes think that real diseases should have real treatments. Well, they do have real treatments. But how many other diseases are there that we have a hard time treating? I mean, cancer is one of those things that we've done so much better at in recent years. But we don't always know exactly how to treat every cancer. Same is true for mental illnesses. It's not always easy to find the right cocktail of treatments. Number four, some say that not all abnormal behavior is the result of a brain disorder, which is true. There are other reasons why some people become anxious, or why people eat too much, or why they make poor choices. Just because people blame mental illness for things that really aren't from mental illness doesn't mean that mental illness is not a real thing. And finally, Finally, some are concerned that the designation mental illness is another of the world's tools to relativize or dismiss sinful behavior. Just because a few people have used a mental illness as an excuse for bad choices, trying to get off in court, maybe even by claiming insanity, just because a few people have misused it doesn't mean it's not true. I mean, I go down the list of things that are misused occasionally that we realize still have value, still are true. Just because one person misuses it doesn't mean it's illegitimate. So I want to think in the rest of our time toward a psychology of depression and other mental illnesses. We talked last week about a theology of mental illness. Today I want to think a little bit about a Christocentric psychology of depression. Thinking theology is the study of God and the things of God. So psychology is the study of the mind and things of the mind. So thinking through the lens of psychology about depression, what would a Christocentric, what would a Christ-centered view of these things look like? So I want to say several things and talk about them together this morning as we think about how to minister to one another and how to even recognize in our own lives the need for the church and for God when it comes to struggling and dealing with mental health issues. First thing I want to say this morning is that your mind is fearfully and wonderfully made. There are no bones about it. Your brain is amazing. No two brains are exactly alike. No two brains work exactly alike. But to begin to understand the brain is something that is just mind-boggling. I mean, scientists spent how many billion dollars and how many thousands upon thousands of hours to map the human genome. You've heard of the genome mapping project. DNA was mapped, human genome. They talk about that's nothing compared to the endeavor they've embarked upon to try to map the brain, the human brain. They say it's going to be 1,000 times harder to map the human brain than it was to map the human genome. And in saying that, they're recognizing they may never do it. That the brain is so complicated. There are things that are firing in your mind constantly, millions upon millions of electrical things that are going on in your mind. It's impossible to understand how complex and amazing your brain is. Even if your brain is slightly ill or has been damaged in some way, it is still a marvel. Your brain is amazing. God has made us in ways that are unfathomable. It's just astounding that we have such complicated bodies and brains that work. Just the fact that you are right now thinking about the football games this afternoon shows how complicated your brain is. Just the fact that you're trying to move your head to get around somebody or perhaps to hide behind somebody or to look at your bulletin instead or you're thinking about this. Isn't it amazing that your brain goes places that it goes? Why in the world why do we dream the way we dream? I mean, why do we have impulses that guide us? Why do we suddenly have a hunger for this? It's astounding. And each person is unique. You are truly fearfully and wonderfully made. Even if you're 90 or 2, Every single human being is a marvel. It's amazing that this thing works. And who could design such a thing? So we need to remember, and I think science, true scientists, are filled with awe. Awe at the human body, awe at the human mind, awe at the splendor of God's creation or creation, the universe. It is amazing. So the second thing is to realize that the worldly ideal of perfection is an evil myth. Some people waste their lives chasing elusive ideals, right? Build the ideal family. Find the ideal spouse. Get the ideal job. Achieve my ideal weight. Have the ideal vacation. On and on it goes. We're chasing ideals. Now, I'm not saying that you ought to set the bar low. Please don't hear me saying that you ought to just marry anyone who's willing to marry you. And please, if you make a mistake of sleeping with somebody, don't compound the mistake by marrying them just because you made one mistake. You know what I'm saying, teens, okay? All right. So you should have some standards, all right? But the kind of standards that I think we ought to aim for are not standards of physical, outward appearance, but standards that are qualities. We want our kids to grow up to be decent human beings, to have compassion, to be good citizens, right? We want those kinds of things. Julie and I are watching The Man in the High Castle. Anybody seen The Man in the High Castle or been through that? Some smattering of hands. It's that Netflix thing that Mika was talking about, Man in the High Castle. This is actually Amazon Prime series. And here's what Man in the High Castle does. It imagines that the Nazis and Japanese won World War II. And so everything east of the Rockies is part of the Greater Reich. And then west of the Rockies is part of the Japanese Empire. Can you imagine? Well, that's what this TV show is trying to do, is to imagine that's what the world looks like. And so we know that this is not just a TV made up thing. This was the real supposition of Nazi Germany, was that there is a master race and that they needed to try to create a society that was free from all defects. So if you are defective in any way, eliminate. That's the standard. If you're crippled, eliminate. Have a brain injury or brain disease, eliminate. And eliminate doesn't mean just kind of move to Siberia. It means eliminate. So the millions of people they eliminated, Jews, gypsies, Slavs, the elderly, those with diseases and disabilities. This is the world that they're creating in this TV show as well. And it's a fascinating, maybe it's a subplot, but maybe it's the main plot. I'm not quite sure yet because we don't know where the show will end up. But it's this thinking of, if you want a society where everybody's perfect, what standard of perfection would you create? Whose standard? Who gets to choose what's perfect? And here's the real problem, is that even if I choose what's perfect, how long will I remain perfect? How long before I have to hide my own imperfections so that they don't eliminate me? See, because here's the reality. No one matches any standard forever. Outward standard. Even if you want to say, okay, well, the ideal is Genesis 2. You have Genesis 2 where you have woman and man, both of them know each other. They just they're gaga over each other. They know each other. They're even naked. I mean, there's like total lack of shame and this total intimacy between two people. Well, not even that standard lasted very long, right? There is no perfect home. There's no perfect job. Whose weight is ideal? And how long do they have it? What's the perfect height? Perfect skin color? What eye color is ideal? What about hair color? See, here's the lies of the evil one that we must name. The ideal of perfection is a lie. Young women, stop idolizing beautiful models. Thank you. Stop it already. You are beautiful. Young guys, stop idolizing famous athletes. You are special. And so on and on we go, trying to match these perfect pictures that we have in our head. And so when we don't measure up, we feel less than. Number three, our differing abilities are part of the complex matrix of our world. I would much rather live in a beautiful world filled with color than in a boring world where everyone is the same. I mean, how do you know that your own personal defects are not, in fact, the sustaining keys to your life? Some of the world's most creative people, for example, have suffered serious mental illness. Anybody ever enjoyed the paintings of Vincent van Gogh? Van Gogh, the Dutch say. I've gotten to visit his museum in Amsterdam. It's not his museum, but the museum dedicated to him and museum. This was a tortured soul, Vincent van Gogh. You know that story of how he cut off his ear at one point? I mean, just, wow, tortured soul. Struggled in so many ways. But his art, that's his self-portrait on the left, his art is amazing. Or you remember a couple of the most prominent suicides from 2018? Anthony Bourdain, travel writer, cook, who changed the way travel writers think of restaurants, think of dining, as opposed to just going to these fancy places that no one can ever go to. He went to the common places. He enjoyed real food, right? Anthony Bourdain, the way he told stories was fascinating. And Kate Spade, such a gifted designer, such a gifted woman, person. Both were haunted by depression and took their own lives. But it makes many of us wonder if there's some link between creativity and depression. They suffered deeply, but they blessed us in so many ways. I'm not suggesting that you should be happy if you have a mental illness or some other difficult burden to carry. But being the same as everybody else doesn't make the world beautiful. It's our differences that make things wonderful. Creativity flows from diversity, not from sameness. And so if we're going to understand that our world is filled with so many different brains, so many different minds, so many different people, we must realize that means that not everybody has the same strengths or the same weaknesses. And finally, we must work together to maintain each other through our weaknesses. So if we want a rich, beautiful, biodiverse world, then we must cultivate it. Some plants and animals, maybe in your own gardens, are fragile. They require special care. Why do you care for plants that are fragile? Because they're beautiful. We cherish their beauty. Same is true for humans. Why do we care for our brothers and sisters who are fragile? Because they are fearfully and wonderfully made. In Grace for the Afflicted, Matthew Stanford talks about the recovery process. And by recovery, we don't mean necessarily always getting over, being able to totally dismiss forever. Many times, depression and other mental illnesses will stay with a person lifelong. It's learning about how to manage and how to deal with these things, how to be in control rather than be controlled, just like in the Black Dog video. And he talks about the stages of recovery. The top line is for those who are actually suffering from mental illness, that when a person is in the depths of depression, they are in a state of distress and they require help to move to a place of stability and from there to a place of function and finally to purpose. And that what often happens is that when somebody has no support network, when they're left alone, think of homeless people, for example, when they're left all alone, they have no support network, they might move to stability for a moment, but because they have no support, they go right back to distress. They can never move to a place of health. It requires help for a person to move from distress to a place of purpose. Why would we care about moving someone who's mentally ill to a place of purpose? Why? Because fragile people are beautiful. 2 Corinthians reads like a believer's guide to dealing with depression. Paul says, "Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Father of mercies and the God of all consolation, who consoles us in all our affliction, so that we may be able to console those who are in any affliction with the consolation with which we ourselves are consoled by God." Think of these words, how many times the word console or consolation is in here. And Paul goes on in this letter to talk about how at one point, chapter 1, verse 8, how he was so unbearably crushed, he despaired of life itself. It sounds like someone struggling with depression. Not that I'm saying Paul was struggling with depression, we don't know. But he was so broken, so beaten down, he despaired of life itself. Then he goes on in chapter 4 to talk about that we are like clay jars carrying this precious treasure from God, but we are such fragile people. And then finally, in chapter 12, he mentions his own thorn in the flesh that he begged God to remove from him. But what is it that God said to him in response? He said, "My grace is sufficient for you, for power is made perfect in weakness." People with mental illness are fearfully and wonderfully made. And they can't do it alone. But think of how much richer, how much more wonderful life is with their gifts and their abilities. We're moving into response time now. And I want to invite some individuals who are going to come to the front to welcome, to pray with anyone who would like to come forward this morning. James 5, 13 through 16 says, "Are any among you suffering? They should pray. Are any cheerful? They should sing songs of praise. Are any among you sick? They should call for the elders of the church and have them pray over them." We're going to enter this time now of prayer and confession so that we might receive the Lord's healing and forgiveness. If you need prayer or encouragement, maybe during a season of anxiety or depression, please come and let one of these folks pray with you. If you need healing for a physical ailment or for a loved one, please come and receive healing prayer. Or if you just need the loving touch of a brother or sister, won't you come forward? God loves you, and we want to be here for each other.